Hi, good afternoon. Welcome to another edition of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Satwinder. It's going to be a fantastic conversation. We've just had a little pre-chat before we got into this to the recording, and I think that you're gonna love this. So, Sat, can you? Nice to see you.
Thank you.
As if we haven't been speaking for 20 minutes before, lovely to meet you. Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, of course. So I'm Satwinder Sandhu. I am currently the chief executive of IAC, the Centre for Adoption. So we are the UK's inter-country adoption centre, but we do work within the UK too. And I'm a social worker, and I'm absolutely immersed, I would say, in the adoption world. So certainly professionally, I mean, it's been an area of interest of mine from when I graduated as a social worker nearly 26 years ago. And I've been fortunate to work with some amazing people and also with some amazing children and families over the years. So hopefully that gives me some sense of what is important in the work that I'm, you know, choosing to be involved in.
Fantastic. 26 years. Wow. Yeah, that's half of my lifetime. I'm 54. That's, 26 years. Wow. So the name of the podcast is Thriving Adoptees. So when I say that phrase to you, Thriving Adoptees, what does that mean to you, Sam?
I think what comes to my mind is thinking about individuals who have been able to understand what their life journey has been, and therefore, you know, what adoption has meant for them, and get to a point where they are functioning and thriving to the best of their ability. And I say that because in all of our lives, we have peaks and troughs, because so many things can come at us from different directions. You know, life brings surprises every single day. So from an adoptee's perspective, obviously within the context of adoption, for me, that really means that they are thriving without adoption being a barrier in the way that I've certainly spoken to people where that feels like it is the case. And thriving for me is such a positive word, because it conjures up so many amazing feelings and visuals and images in my head and in my body. And it feels very aspirational. So I guess part of that thought process for me is that thriving can be a journey. It doesn't necessarily have to be a limit or a cap on this journey. It can be something that keeps evolving and keeps you moving forwards, even when there are obstacles in the way that might set you back. So actually, I guess for me, in summary, it's about being able to be focused and keep moving forward and positive and in one's life, and make it what you want it to be.
Yeah. Wow, I love that. I was going to ask you to explain a little bit more about your story, but I think we've got a good flavour of that already, and there's so much richness in there. If I don't follow up on some of the things that you just mentioned, I'm going to forget them. So you were, I need a bigger desk so that I can get my notepad on here as well as doing the Zoom. So you said understanding the journey. So you said understanding the journey, and you said the word that leapt out to me is about functioning. The functioning one. And the reason it leapt out for me is because I've had a lot of coaching in my life, and that has been a fantastic for me. I've spoken to a few therapists. I thought I didn't get the same vibe off the therapist that I did, but I did go to see one. And it did lead me on my journey, but it at the moment, in the time I was there, it didn't seem to be a particularly great step. But she did give me her notes. And the reason that the word functioning stood out is because she wrote to me, she wrote down that I was high functioning. High functioning. So understanding the past and the functioning bit, I'm very intrigued, obviously, in the functioning thing. So I do think it's quite funny that she put this thing down as high functioning. And functioning and keeping going no matter what. And essentially, I think the word that I've heard that kind of sums up what you're talking about is the fact that life is a contact sport. And you know, you're talking about the obstacles. So let's break it down then. So understanding, functioning, and moving it forward. So what is it that you have? Let's look at the understanding one first then, understanding the past. What do you mean by?
So we know, obviously, that when adoption is in your life as an adoptee, it means that there has been loss involved. And inevitably that loss occurs at a very young age, or certainly in childhood, where as a child, there's very little control over the circumstances or the outcome of what this might mean. So inevitably this is, in the context of adoption, usually involves some sort of formal process and intervention. The legalities aside, it just means that something has happened in your life where you have been separated then, certainly from the person that birthed you. And we've talked a lot in adoption about the loss and trauma that that alone can bring, even for babies separated, you know, at or soon after birth. And as somebody who's not an adoptee, I can't for one minute claim that I have the level of empathy it might need to understand what that really truly means and feels like. So I wouldn't ever want to claim to know that, because the reality is I don't, and I can't, and I never will. But as a human being who has faced adversity and challenges in other contexts that have also involved separation and loss and high levels of emotion that hasn't always been positive, I would hope that, as you know, I can demonstrate some level of empathy that would understand what that might result in. And I say that because I've worked as a social worker, as I said, for 26 years. All of that work has been with children and families. A lot of it has been with children in foster care and those needing permanence and adoption. And so I've certainly worked closely with children who are living with that experience on a day-to-day and seen what that can mean in terms of their behavior, their ability or inability to regulate their emotions and understand their emotions, the inability and sometimes challenges faced by the carers, whether foster carers or family members or adopters, to manage and understand those emotions. So one can't minimize what that means. But the understanding bit, I think, of it is really important because we know so much about what it means. You know, there's a lot of research out there. Adoptees who are adults now themselves have told us what it looks like, feels like from the inside, from the outside, and their families, whatever the makeup of those families is, whether birth families or adoptive families. And so I think we've got a lot that we can use to build a platform on where we can start to think about, well, these are the common themes that we hear over and over. And in social work, we're never going to be able to have a one-size-fits-all approach. But I think in order to create services that meet the needs of adoptees and also adopters to some degree, and as a leader of an organization, that's what I have to go on. Yeah. So my objective is always to do my best to listen, to understand, to empathize, and make sure that things never stand still. So actually what is right today or 5 years ago or in 5 years' time won't always be the only solution or the right solution. And one of the things I'm really conscious about is that in 2021, we're at a point where adoption is changing and evolving, and rightly so. And all of the people affected by adoption should be given a voice to inform what this means in terms of how adoption evolves from a legal perspective, certainly. And I'm probably talking all over the place, but I think for me, you know, this is a conversation that never ends, because I'm constantly trying to understand and be sure that what I'm doing day to day, my job, and what my organization is doing, and particularly as an organization involved in international adoption, where there's a whole additional layer of complexities because children are physically leaving their countries of birth to join a new family in a new country. I hope I would always be wanting to ensure that our services reflected as vast an array of experiences as possible.
Yeah.
Have I answered your question in any way?
Yes, I think, yes, you have, in a very elegant way, very far-reaching strategic way. The one thing that I wanted to come back with, I discovered this last week, and I'm wondering whether... This is an American professor whose name I forget, but he's from Harvard Medical School, and he's also like a professor of pediatrics. Mm. I'll add a link to the show notes with his name in it and with him to this. It was a podcast, and he said, "We've got this really, you know, this understanding piece, a lot of." Talk about trauma in adoption, in that understanding of what's happening. And this professor said that there was actually no empirical evidence behind the work of Nancy Verrier's book, The Primal Wound.
Oh, gosh.
Now, I'm just wondering why. Well, this came as big news to me, but very empowering news and very validating news, because when I read that book, it took me down.
Yeah,
I believed it. You know, we use the word authority, don't we? Mm. And authority. The first part of the word of authority is author. We tend to believe authors, and it took me very down. Did that book, and it disempowered me in terms of like. Essentially, it said my behavior is shackled to something that happened 48 years ago. I was reading this book, and it's very, very disempowering, and a lot of people still using that book. I've talked about this before, but I went down like when you're trying to push a football down underwater or a beach ball down in the water. Reading this book and this empowerment, however meant, it took me down. And then when I realized that it wasn't true, the ball bounced out high into the high, you know, high 5 foot above the. 5 foot above the level of the swimming pool. And I thought, and then when I read this stuff about no empirical evidence, and I'm just wondering, to what extent is this negative narrative? We seem to have a negative bias within society, you know, in every, we talked briefly about COVID, didn't we, before then? We seem to have a little bit, we seem to have a lot of negativity bias. We have a lot of confirmation bias. And to what extent are we talking ourselves down a dark rabbit hole?
I think that's a really interesting reflection, Simon. So for me, in my 26 years, I've lost count of the number of children and families I will have worked with who have been affected by adoption. But I have to say, so it probably runs into thousands in the context of all of the roles I've been fortunate to have. And I have to say that the concept of the primal wound has featured in a really, you know, in a minority. And that's not to say that it's not valid or that it's founded with, you know, incorrect research or evidence bases, but I think it's like anything in life. We all react to circumstances very, very differently. And I think to categorize a whole group of people because of their status, and in this case, their status of being an adoptee, in this way actually isn't the most helpful lens to view this subject through. So, and as I've said, you know, people go on different journeys, and I think it's not for an author or an authority or a researcher to tell people what they, you know, what the root cause of their feelings and their life journey has been. It's one hugely important factor. But I don't think it's the only factor, because actually there's so many circumstances that shape what happens from the second that separation occurs, whether it's at birth, a few hours later, a week or years later. And I think it's bordering on dangerous territory to go that far and say this is a one-size-fits-all approach. And the primal wound itself was a very powerful and well-publicized book. And I know certainly social workers and adopters and adoptees who treated it like the gospel. And personally, I didn't. And that's not because I wanted to minimize or reject what it might be telling us, but that wasn't my experience. And at the time I was first made aware of that book, I was a relatively junior social worker. And I was already seeing that by working with a diverse group of adoptive parents and their children, what each of those individual children and each of those family units needed from me as their social worker and from the world around them was unique. And that's how I've always worked. So yes, there may be systems and processes in place that create a particular experience for children and families, but actually what going back to your original question about what makes or helps adoptees to thrive, there's such an array of different things. And I think working through any emotions that might result of that separation from a birth parent is a hugely important part of the journey towards thriving. But to summarize it as the primal wound, I don't think is the only way to view it.
Yeah. So I like that. I love that. So I think it is about trusting our own experience and trusting our own experience in the moment and doing what's best for ourselves and for the kids.
Yeah.
Kids in our care.
And I think the role of people like me and adoption agencies is to provide the knowledge, tools, education, support that children and families who are affected by adoption, whether it's birth parents or adopters, is to provide that access to support and knowledge. So for me, I mean, I'll keep talking about journeys, and I don't want to, you know, make it sound trite, but when somebody is thinking about starting or growing their family through adoption and they come to an organization like mine, inevitably there's a level of emotion driving that decision. And usually there's a level of naivety, particularly in 2021, when we know that whether children are being placed in England or from across the world, 99.9% of those children will have experienced not only the separation we're referring to, but trauma and possible abuse And where children may have, you know, lived in institutions, that adds a whole layer of other complexities onto their life experience so far. So the reality is, any person choosing to adopt these days is going to be faced with additional challenges to parents who are giving birth to their own children and fortunate enough to be raising them in a relatively stable surrounding with a home and the ability to provide them with shelter and nurture and food. But the reality is that when we're talking about that journey, it's so different for different people. So my response as an adoption agency is to make it as supportive as possible. And one of the things that I've introduced IAC since I've been here, just over 2 years now, is that adoption is for life, and so is our support. And so one of the things we're actively working on at the moment is looking beyond what we think about as adoption support, which is, you know, being there when families are struggling and getting access to therapy and health assessments and whatever else that might mean. But thinking of this lifelong trajectory, you know, for the adoptee, that status of being adopted is just part of them. And I see it as our responsibility to make sure it's as fully integrated as part of them as possible. Whether that's been a positive or another experience, in a way, is not an aside, but is secondary. Because regardless of what the experience has been, the status of being an adoptee is never going to shift. And even if you're reunified with birth parents, you know, the experience and lived life that you've had won't change. And so the lifelong approach to adoption support for me is absolutely essential, and a responsibility and an obligation for all adoption agencies to deliver on. Because having spoken to adoptees and listened to adult adoptees speaking about their experiences, we know that there are so many times in life when adoption as, and I'll call it an issue, I don't mean that in a complicated or negative way, but when adoption as an issue will rise to the surface. And one of the things I've heard repeatedly is people saying, when I had my own child, particularly women who were then giving birth to a baby, having been an adoptee themselves, they simply weren't aware or prepared for the emotions that they were going to feel when they held that baby for the first time after birth or soon after. Because what I've been told repeatedly is what comes back to them is these images of their own birth mother and what it must have been like for her to have this baby and then either have the child removed or have to give the baby up or whatever the circumstances were that involved that removal and adoption. And for me, it's just a no-brainer. Sure, yes, this is a given. You know, IAC and other agencies need to be here. So you, when you feel you need us, can just come to us and say, look, I'm going through this. What's available for me? And I think by having a much more rounded view of adoption support and what adoptees really need in order to thrive will go a long way towards helping adoptees manage and understand the highs and lows that come with that life experience.
So you've talked about information, you talked about information and support. Clearly on our podcast, it's kind of more about information than support. Mm. So what are the most important things that you would say to an adoptive parent who's listening to this and who wants to do even more? You mean, the first off is, if they've got this far to the podcast, got to the podcast, they're listening, they're already in the zone. They're already hanging out for insights. They're already curious.
Yeah.
What would you like to? So that's a pat on the back for you, dear listener, if you're doing this, because what I've seen again and again is actually adoptive parents are keener. They are more open. They are more curious. They are willing to learn. They are more willing to challenge their own ideas about what they think parenting should be. And that is exactly the place where you're going to learn more. So what would you like to share, Sat, in terms of the information about what you found best helps?
I think there has to be openness and reality. And in the past, we've heard a lot about, you know, adoptees not being told that they were adopted, coming across it as an adult in really unforeseen circumstances, sometimes as awful as, you know, opening the contents of a dead parent's safety deposit box only to find an adoption certificate or whatever that might be. So that completely is the other end of where we want our adopters to be. So the openness, by what I mean by that, is that from day one, when you're working with an adoption agency of any description, whether it's a local authority, regional adoption agency, or a voluntary like IAC, there is a need to be immersed in reality. And if your reality is that infertility has brought you to adoption as a way to have a family, you're already on the journey to this being a different experience. And nobody has the right to be a parent. And yet we know there are lots of times we hear about awful stories and think, well, this person should never have been allowed to have a child, or why was this allowed to happen to this poor baby, et cetera, et cetera. But for an adoptive parent, you are going to be raising a child not yours through birth. So therefore, inevitably, that child, you know, doesn't belong to somebody else, but has come from somebody else. And an openness to accept what that means in its wholeness, I think, is so important. And my experience of working with adoptive parents who've been able to do this and to embrace the child and everything they come with often means actually the depth of the relationship you're able to build with your adopted child is so much deeper and more honest, because there's no then boundary or no-go zone. So as a child is growing and understanding what it means to be adopted, you're able to have those conversations and to spoon feed them in a child sensitive way what that means for them, what their circumstances may have meant, what brought you together as a family, why you were brought to adoption as a prospective parent, and all of those different facets that go up to make you a unique family. And the openness bit is really about never having to shut down emotionally. And one of the things that I think adoptive parents have got very skilled at and need to be very skilled at is pushing through that pain. So whether you're dealing with challenges or whether you're dealing with a child who's experiencing all kinds of trauma or acting out violence towards you, whatever it might be, yes, support is absolutely essential, but at the end of the day, as the parent, you have to find a way to push through. And that pain might be physical, it might be emotional, it might just be psychological, but it's a threshold that needs to be crossed. And by choosing to be a parent, whether you're adopting a child or having one by birth, you're putting yourself in that space. You're saying, actually, I want to raise a child, I want to be the parent, and therefore, by default, the request is always going to be that you go the extra mile for your child. And I think for adopters who can do that, with the support of social workers and agencies like ours, who have a different perspective on what support is needed, hopefully you can do that, because children in any circumstance will test parents. And you can be absolutely sure that as an adoptive parent, your child is going to test you in emotional ways that you might not be prepared for. So the more open and inclusive you are about your status as an adoptive family, about the family tree that by nature then becomes extended and includes the birth family, even if they're not active in your lives and there's no contact, which is changing, you know, rapidly these days. So there is more and more contact, which I think, whilst it can feel threatening, also adds a level of resilience to you as a family, because actually, again, there's nothing hidden. There's no fantasies about what it means to be adopted or what this other family might be like. And I can only imagine that that creates strength. And that's been my experience of the families I've worked with personally before I was a manager and a chief exec. when I was in people's homes, these are the sorts of conversations we would have. And but the feedback for me was that this is what brought strength to that relationship as an adoptive parent.
Wow. This is big stuff. This is big stuff.
Yeah, it is. But I guess it doesn't need to be. Because actually,
I mean good. Yeah.
On a day-to-day, this is just what we want our adoptive parents to just do by second nature. And I think, therefore, you know, if we're thinking about our responsibility as an adoption agency, we're there to make sure that that happens and that we're providing everything that's needed to enable that to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. So the resilience piece is a fascinating area for me. You know, and you talked about keeping going, and you said, you know, when we were talking about functioning and keeping going and overcoming obstacles. What I guess you're saying is that we need to, the adults need to do this so the kids follow suit. Is that?
Yeah. I think so. I think parents inevitably always need to lead the way.
Yeah.
So if you are, you know, I've heard so many times people say, well, we've never talked about that because they've never brought it up. And it's like, well, children won't, because children tune into communication and language in a way that as adults we're closed off to, because, you know, we've been around a lot longer and we've become a bit tough and desensitized. So children, and especially children who've experienced trauma, we know from the medical research that they will be hypersensitized to certain emotions and feelings and what's happening around them. So unless we're giving really open, clear cues, children won't ask or delve, and therefore parents have to be exemplary. And I know there's been criticism about the adoption process and saying we're looking for super parents and adoptive parents have to be better than everybody else. Why is that? Why is that? And my answer always is, well, anybody that's taking on responsibility for a child that isn't theirs by birth has that expectation of them by default. Otherwise, leave it to somebody else who can, quite frankly, do a better job.
Yeah.
So nobody has a right to be a parent. Certainly nobody has an automatic right to be approved as suitable to adopt and then have a child placed with them. So there is a process to go through, because we have to, aside from the safeguarding aspects of having to make sure that as far as possible people are going to be safe. And sadly, we know that's not always the case, because the reality is, you know, for children who have been injured, abused or died in the care of adoptive parents or foster carers tells us that. So again, as a social worker in this field, I'm always conscious that, you know, what are we missing sometimes? So by making it an objective to inform and educate and support prospective adopters as to the nth degree possible, I think it's always then not just about doing a better job, it's always about minimizing more risk. And I think the more positivity that can be injected right throughout this piece, because I don't want to make it sound as though, you know, if you come to IAC, they will put you through the mill and tell you about all these awful things that you're going to experience as a family and then hope for the best at the end of it. It really isn't like that. It's about looking at all of these issues that we know so much about now through a positive lens and being proactive rather than reactive.
Yeah.
So if you are armed and forewarned that this might happen, or that if this happens, this is what you can do, then great. And I think most adoption agencies now are therefore running some sort of parenting courses after the child has been placed for adoption. Not because we don't think you can do what's required, but because we recognize it changes all the time. So parenting is changing. What it's like to raise a child now in 2021 is so different to what my parents would have experienced in the 70s and 80s. And so we're just wanting to be at the forefront and offering what we know you might need.
I want to just take you back a couple of minutes because you said the word exemplary, and I think you used it in a different context. So exemplary, or maybe it's just my take on your English, was exemplary is normally held up as kind of perfection, being exemplary, be. But what you were talking about was being like what Gandhi, like what Gandhi said. See, I came across a bit northern and that, yeah, and uneducated, not very elegant in my language there at all. Gandhi said something about being the change that we want to see in the world, and exemplary as a way as I understood it in your context was about being the person that we want our children to be, or being modeling, behaving as we want to. Is
Yeah,
that
as
what
far
you're
as possible, because I think again, we want to live in reality, and that we all have challenges, we'll have good days, bad days, as will our children, and nobody can be exemplary or perfect all the time. But I guess it's this, what I think I was meaning was when you're comparing the average parent to what we expect of our adopters, it feels like that sometimes, that you've always got to be up here. And that's not what we're saying. We're saying there will be ups and downs. You'll have your good days, you'll have your bad days. That's why support is so important. Not just from social workers and agencies, but from your friends, your family, your peers, from school, all those other people involved in your child's life. And but we hear so many stories about children who struggle to have their needs met, not only at home, but in school or by health services. And I think there are so many issues that can affect your, I'll use the word performance, because we'll know what I mean by it, but your performance as a parent
Yeah.
and as an adoptive parent particularly. So I think we just have to be real and acknowledge that. That doesn't mean to say adoption shouldn't exist, or that we shouldn't be striving to find families for children who need permanence through adoption. And because I think the really simple answer to some of these debates is, well, adoption should just shouldn't happen, or it's outdated, or that we don't need it anymore, because actually it closes off a whole emotional chapter of a child's life in a way that's unhealthy. So I think we can learn from all of those experiences. And as I said earlier, some of my most profound light bulb moments have come when I've heard adult adoptees speaking about their life experience and telling us what it was like, whether it was positive or not. And it's about what we take from that and then what we make better and different. And I think adoption has a long life ahead of it as a concept, but one that will be different to what we've previously understood. And that's why I love this work. That's why I want to be involved in that debate and shaping it going forwards, because I think there is so much we can still be doing to make it better.
Yeah. Could you share some of those light bulb moments? Are there any of those light bulbs moments that you think would be useful for the any adopted parents listening
Well,
to?
one of them I've touched on already, which was really about hearing about the life experiences of adopted adults and when adoption as a concept rises to the surface. So becoming a parent yourself, or like those life-defining moments. And for me, that was a light bulb moment, because I thought we're so focused on childhood and dealing, with the struggles, that actually the resources and services for adopted adults therefore start to diminish once you move past 18, with this expectation that suddenly then everything will be fine. And that's not the case. So that's certainly set me on this path and mission of creating different types of services that people can access at any point. And I think one of the other light bulb moments really is just this whole thing about, well, actually, it's not so light bulb because I think the light was maybe on a dimmer and just got brighter. But it was,
Brilliant.
this whole thing about adoption not being necessary. And I kind of then go back and I think, well, if adoption didn't exist, what would happen? And I guess in England, children would stay with foster carers, or we might invest more in resources for kinship carers. But for me, both of those types of permanence bring huge, huge positives in terms of, we've got people who are willing to step forward and care for our most vulnerable children. But there's something about, for me, there's something about adoption creating a different legal relationship. And I know that's what drives a lot of criticism because people feel it's unnecessary to do that. I think I'm of the opposite view. I think it is necessary. And without trivializing it, one of the reasons I say that is because I often liken it to living with a partner as opposed to marrying them. So when you're living together as a couple, it doesn't mean your relationship is any less loving or valid or productive. But actually, if times become tough and the thought of leaving enters your mind, sometimes it's as easy as packing a case because there's nothing else tying you together. Yes, there might be a home or a rental or mortgage or whatever, but actually walking away is an option. And it's sometimes from working with foster families, that's how it sometimes feels in fostering, that actually when things get really tough, it's easy to say, I can't deal with this anymore. You're going to have to find another home for this child. And that's why sometimes research has shown that in fostering, placement breakdown rates can be as high as 40 to 50%, if not higher. And I'm talking about permanent foster care placement, so where the plan has been this child is remaining with this family till they're 18. And I've personally worked with families where that has happened. And it's been staggeringly shocking because this is, these are families where the child may have lived for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. And in adoption, it's more like a marriage. You go through a legal process that changes your legal relationship. And therefore, if you want to leave a marriage, after that's happened, you've got to be really sure that you're prepared to go through the legal separation process. And I think there's a similarity there with adoption, because actually, when things are tough, by and large, most adopters keep going and find ways to pull through. And I don't think it's just by chance. I think there is psychologically a shift that has occurred. And we know that adoption sometimes don't work and children have to go back to foster care or institutions. So I'm not trying to, paint this through fairy tales lenses, but overall, the last significant piece of research that Julie Selwyn did on adoption breakdown rates showed that they were as low as 3 to 9%. Now that's a huge difference to the statistics in long-term foster care. And I think anybody that steps for themselves forward to become a kinship carer or a foster carer or an adopter is doing something amazing. And I don't mean that in a patronizing way. I genuinely believe that having worked with the children who need these homes. But I think there is a difference between what is created by adoption. And so I am a champion of adoption because I believe in it. And some people will say that's overly optimistic and positive, but I don't subscribe to that because I think unless you are overly optimistic and positive, then we'd all just grind to a halt.
We would, yeah.
So I really believe passionately that children belong in families, and I think more children could be adopted.
I guess it's the commitment. I was thinking about that as a how that would have been if I'd been fostered rather than adopted, and then how I would have felt. I mean, obviously, you can only speculate. There's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of what if in there.
Absolutely.
But yeah, if we want the firmest of foundations.
Yeah, and outcomes
for family to for adopted kids to for yeah. kids to thrive.
Absolutely, and the outcomes for children leaving care are still, you know, nowhere near good enough, and that includes children leaving permanent foster care, and there's still no, you know, staying put has been around for a long time now, but there's huge problems with that as a concept and as a resource, and children are still saying, actually, when they've left permanent foster homes, they don't always feel like they still belong. And that's no criticism of the foster carers. It's a criticism of the system.
Yeah.
And we don't hear that in the same way from adult adoptees, because they know where they belong.
Yeah.
And for me, that's hugely important. And there are enough challenges in life that all of us have to face and navigate, and adoptees, as we've talked about, have a whole additional range of challenges right from the moment they're conceived. And I may be oversimplifying it, but I don't wish to add additional unnecessary complexities to those already complex lives.
So let's go back to the functioning piece then. We talked about understanding and functioning and keeping going, and so what do you see working in that area for the differences that make the difference in great adoptions?
So I think that I've worked in two organisations now, voluntary organisations, where we've had a really broad range of services available to children and families who are adopters and adoptees. And from my experience, what works best is when you have a mix of services that range from highly sophisticated clinical services right through to less scripted kind of services that are still informed through things like play therapy and therapy and stuff like that. So about nurturing attachment and, you know, self-esteem. And I think what works best is when we don't take a one-size-fits-all approach, where we have the resource to work with a child and to work with a family to make a proper assessment about what might be going on. And I say might because I think we make a lot of assumptions about what is going on. So not just because of things like the primal wound, but because attachment sometimes is confused with other disorders, and, you know, learning difficulties are sometimes confused with emotional delay. And so there's a, you know, we need really skilled people making those initial assessments. And then, once we know what might be going on, having a hypothesis around that, and then deciding what sort of service is going to work best for this particular child.
And what about for the parents listening then? So that for the parents listening, is it about looking at different options, having a being curious, spreading the net wide in terms of what you think is going to best.
Yeah, I think there's
best suit you as a parent and your child.
There's, I think, the same principle in a way, because actually it's about, you know, when we feel ill, and we think it's serious enough to need a doctor's intervention, we try to get an appointment to see a GP. And I guess what I'm saying is for adoptive parents to have a broader response option than that. And they can't do this themselves. And it goes back to this thing about, you know, adoption support being flexible, being robust, being offered. at different stages, because actually if the resource doesn't exist, then what I'm saying becomes meaningless. Then the only option is perhaps to go to a GP or seek help, you know, through some sort of NHS service. So it's about recognizing that your child needs support. That's first and foremost, because sometimes there's a downplaying of that need in itself. Making sure that the support you're seeking is adoption informed. I'm still staggered that I talk to teachers, and when I speak about attachment issues and children who are adopted or fostered experiencing different sorts of trauma and how that might play out in school, they don't know anything about it. I just think, how is that possible? And so your support has to be adoption informed, whether it's from school or from an adoption agency or elsewhere. And then it has to be flexible. And I think if you go into even quite a sophisticated form of support with an approach that says, this might only just touch the surface, or it might not help now, but it might start to manifest itself in 3, 6, 9 months time, that's a healthier approach. Because the other danger is parents are told support is available. They therefore expect the support to be quick and functioning and fix the issue, and then they can move on. And I guess life is a journey that evolves day by day, week by week, and adoption as a journey is no different. So what feels like it's been addressed now and fixed in quotations might not be in 6 months or a year's time, because actually something else might come that compounds or resurrects that issue. And I think if adoptive parents are doing that in the context of trying to just be the best parents that they can be, it will feel like it's just part and parcel of your approach as an adoptive parent, rather than it's something special that you've got to do or something complicated that your child has to go through to get support. Does that make sense?
It does. And I guess it, as we bring this in to end of a fascinating conversation, are there resources on your site for that people can check out on this?
At the moment, I think Adoption UK and organisations like that probably will have better range of resources, because some of the resources on IAC's website will be very inter-country adoption based. But we have just been really fortunate to secure some funding from the National Lottery Community Fund to develop some online modules with the Adopter Hub. Now, the Adopter Hub is an online digital platform run by PACT, Parents and Children Together, and it's an amazing resource for adoptive parents. It's a range of online and live and video tools and resources that cover a whole range of the issues that we've touched on today, Simon. So from identity to attachment to transracial adoption, you know, all kinds of things that people are dealing with. So resources like that, I think, are amazing. And of course, during the pandemic that we are still living through, they've really come into their own, because that's how we're all now working.
So I'll put some links on there to the show notes, and a link to your site as well. Is there anything else that you'd like to, any question that I haven't asked that you'd like to, anything that you'd like to share?
Not so much a question, but I think for me, you know, one of the reasons I was so keen to speak with you, apart from having, you know, some insight into the work that you're doing and your own experience of being an adopted person, I think for me, you know, it goes back to this concept of every child should be in a family. And despite, you know, some of the observations I've made, I genuinely believe that a loving family, regardless of the legal status, is the best possible, you know, home for a child. So I don't want people to get the impression that I'm fixated on adoption, but I do as a leader of an adoption agency in this sector, if I didn't believe that, then, you know, I shouldn't be in the role that I'm in. But I do think that my message is we could be doing more, not just in terms of support, but I think Because adoption has become loaded with so many negative connotations, I think what I have seen in the social work profession is we're less able to see it as a positive outcome for a child. So it's almost starting to be viewed as something that's, last resort and negative, partly because of what's been said in court judgments that, it should be the last possible, which I agree with. No child should be legally separated from their family unless it is the only option available. But I think we're leaving too many children in limbo in the middle. And that's why the numbers of children on adoption plans are dropping, not just because more kinship family members are coming forward. I think it's because we're seeing adoption as an option for less children systematically. And on the flip side of that, the You Can Adopt campaigns that have been running for the last year and a half have seen record numbers of people come forward. And whilst they might not be ready or have what it needs in terms of space and availability and all the rest of it to come forward right now, the fact that people are engaging in this emotional dialogue and stepping forward to care for a vulnerable child to me says more, which says actually there's people out there willing to do this. And what I'd love to see happen is more of what's happening in the USA and a slightly older group of children in that bracket of 6 to 10, who at the moment we aren't even thinking about for adoption, are all back in the mix. So actually, if a family is coming forward and saying, we can love this child and care for them through adoption, I still, based on everything I've said earlier, I think that's a better outcome for that child potentially, if it's the right family.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Sat. It's been a fantastic and fascinating
Thank
conversation. I really
you.
appreciate you coming on. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been really, every time I have these conversations, my mind sets off on, 300 different tangents. So I'll have a lot to reflect on myself. So thank you, Simon.
Thanks a lot. And for those who want to check out more about what I do, my work, don't check out my website. It's thrivingadoptees.com. I was listening to something about podcasts this morning, and I realized that I've been finishing off these podcasts without telling where people they can find out more about me. And I think, oh, that's a bit silly, isn't it? Anyway, so we live and learn. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Sam. Take care.
Thank you, Simon. Take care.